I'm still John, and I'm still an alcoholic. And it gives me great pleasure and honor to introduce our speaker this evening. I actually did not ask him to come here and tell his story this evening. Another alumni member, Allison, did. And it made me happy, or it excited me when she told me several months ago that she had asked Dana to come tell his story first Friday, because I've known Dana for quite a number of years. He and I go to a men's meeting on Monday nights up at the Howe place up in Woodstock. So I've heard bits and pieces of Dana's background, his story, as he would share in meetings. And when he shares in meetings, everybody shuts up and listens, because he's always got something very good to say. I've also gone on a lot of, we do a men's retreat, the Howe place does, in October. And Dana will lead a big book study the two evenings that we're at this. And I have availed myself of that for a number of times. And several years ago, I even would go here. Dana was volunteering his time freely at the men's extension over there off of the Church Street extension. And he ran a big book study. And I must say, I don't know anybody that knows the big book like you do. Sometimes, if you were a little older, I'd wonder if you knew Bill and Bob personally. But Dana knows that big book. Now, I don't think that's what he's going to do tonight, is conduct a big book study. But I have heard parts of his story before, and I know what he's got. A great, he's got a lot of experience and strength and hope. And so, with that, I give you Dana.
Perfect. Can you hear me? Hey, my name is Dana. I'm a real alcoholic. You know, you put a big book in my hand and I can get up in front of a bunch of people and I don't ever worry about it or get nervous or anything like that. But whenever I have to tell my story, it's always so nerve-wracking to me. I don't know why that happens. I'm not ashamed to bare my soul or anything like that. It's just, maybe it's my pride or my ego, you know, that gets in the way. And so, but I'm here tonight, and I'm gonna share my experience, strength, and hope with you all fine folks. And my hopes is that somebody will hear something tonight that helps them on their journey of recovery, because that's all I want to do. That's all we want to do together, is to help each other on this journey called recovery we're on. It starts out, I was born in Vermont. My sobriety date is May 28th, 1996. I was born in Vermont in 1964. I'm 53 years old, and 54. Oops, I'm getting older. My family. My father had a construction business that was built like hospitals and schools and things like that, and did pretty well for himself. And my family was doing very well for themselves. And then in 1976, when the construction crunch came, we lost everything. And it was that early in life that I started feeling less than, you know? And it's so strange, because I was probably around 9 or 10 years old, and I started to feel less than, and I started to feel fear. My dad was married. My mother, she passed away when I was 3 years old in the middle of childbirth. They cut her bowels and she poisoned to death in 7 days. And my dad married shortly thereafter again, his secretary. And my dad was married 6 times after my mother. So, you know, I don't blame my addiction, or I don't blame anything on my upbringing, but my upbringing was not Ozzie and Harriet. It was very, a lot of fear, a lot of dysfunction. I never would call my dad an alcoholic, but he drank like an alcoholic and acted like one. And but he provided for us, and we were doing well. So we went bankrupt in Vermont, and we had a vacation home down in Hilton Head. And so we moved to Hilton Head, and in Hilton Head, somewhere around 1977, 1978, Hilton Head was a very affluent area, and we came in basically bankrupt. And my family started a couple small businesses. My dad did, going through some marriages and stuff like that. And that feeling, that same feeling was always there of feeling less than, you know? And it was real easy to do, you know, when you're going to school and kids are driving Ferraris and Porsches and Mercedes and, you know, it's all you can do to get something to get to school and stuff like that. And I put a lot of hope and faith in material things and felt less than about myself. And this went on, you know, for a few years. And I wasn't drinking yet or using or anything like that. And then my dad had married his secretary, which was his second wife, and she was insane, literally, and she used to beat me, and they got divorced, but they kept getting back together, you know, and so he was going to have her come down to Hilton Head for the weekend, and I was petrified, and so that's when I took my first drink, And my dad kept alcohol around the house, obviously, and I drank some vodka, and this was when y'all are so young, but you know, skateboarding was really popular back in the early 80s, late 70s, and I was a big skateboarder, and I ended up drinking a bunch of this vodka, and I got drunk. And I fell off the skateboard, and I split my head open, and I broke my arm. And the only thing that I thought about was I wasn't scared anymore, and it started working for me. And the only other thing I was thinking about was I remember I want to feel like that again. I don't want to feel that fear anymore. And so, right from the beginning, I used alcohol as a crutch for this fear and this inferiority that I felt so much of. And she came in town, and she was as nice as she could have been, and she left. And it wasn't then that I started drinking on a regular basis. I was probably 12 or 13, and I had some older brothers, and you know, every now and then on the weekend we would drink a little beer or Boone's Farm strawberry wine was a big one back then, and we'd go out and to be honest with you, it wasn't a problem. I wasn't needing to have alcohol. I enjoyed the times that I did, but I didn't need to have it. And so this went on through high school. I was a percussionist. I played in the orchestra. I played musicals in the orchestra, and I also played in the marching band. I was really involved in that, and I used to enjoy doing that, but in the orchestra that I played in, I was the youngest person playing, and people would buy me drinks, and you know, I would play on the weekends and go to school. And then when I wasn't playing in the orchestra, I played in a bar, and I played, I was the house drummer, so musicians would come in without a drummer, and they would use I would play for these folks, and that would drink at the bar. And it, you know, that's kind of what it was like. It wasn't bad. I didn't drink in the morning. I didn't drink or anything like that. And in high school, I fell in love and took my first hostage. And, you know, I was about 15 and she was about 13. And, you know, I thought we were gonna get married. I thought I loved this girl. She had a really stable family. And I felt safe around her, and you know, we drank a little bit going to the prom and stuff, but it wasn't anything like that. Anyway, right around my senior year, we dated for a few years, right around my senior year, she left me for another person, and I was devastated. And in my mind, I was like, I'm going back to what I know best. And this, at this time, involved other substances on top of alcohol. And I was really using alcohol and drugs a lot more at that time than just casually and having fun with my friends and stuff like that. I was using it to numb the pain. I was using it to fly from reality and things like that. And that's when I met the Jamaicans. And the Jamaicans like to freebase, and you know, it was all of this, and I realized, and I was working, my dad had started these businesses, and I was working for my dad's businesses, and I was out of high school, and I was thinking about going to college, but I hadn't gone to college yet, and so my dad, I told my dad, I said, I want to go to college, and because I thought, hence my first geographic change, that would straighten me out, would help me out, you know. And when I first got out of high school, I had a good job. I was playing in the orchestra, playing in the bar, working for my dad. I had plenty of money, and I bought myself a brand new BMW. And when I went to college, my dad took my BMW away, and I was pretty bummed out about it. So I went to college, and I went to Lees McRae College in Banner Elk, North Carolina. And I went up there, and my dad, being in the addiction and through his marriages and stuff like that, he really relied on me a lot to help him with the businesses. And when I left, he was having a lot of struggles. I didn't have my car. I didn't have any money. What I was doing at Lees McRae College was snow skiing every day. I really wasn't studying or anything like that. I just got away, and I was still doing the same thing, you know, drinking and all that other nonsense. And so I stayed at Lees McRae for 3 months, and I decided to come home. And I came home, went back to work for my father's company, and you know, I was still at this point able to control my drinking. You know, I wasn't drinking in the morning. I was partying, you know, and hanging out and stuff like that. And I met my first wife. And my first wife and I, we fell in love over drugs and alcohol. That's what our deal was. And I was 21, she was 24, 25, and we got married. And we got married, and my dad had two businesses. One of the businesses he had was a party rental business, you know, for weddings and golf tournaments and things like that. So I took that part of the business, bought it from him, and was making payments. And me and my wife were going to run this business, and I was going to pay him off, and I was going to build this business. I wasn't ready yet. And it gave me access to a lot of money, you know. And I could do the things, and my habits were expensive. And so, you know, I was using a lot more during the day, a lot more on the, you know, in the evenings, every day type of an occurrence. So it was getting worse, but I didn't think it was a problem. You know, I didn't think it was a problem at all. I thought it was just fun. I thought it's what I was doing. And my ex-wife came to work with me. We started this business, and we hired this lady, and me and her got real close, and she became my mistress, and we fired my wife, and it was really dysfunctional, and we're using, and it's just a hot mess, and I'm using the money that I'm supposed to pay my dad to support my habits, and he's mad, and And so it really wasn't a good time. About this time, my dad died. He died of a massive heart attack. And the first thing that I did when he died was I went to the dealer to get some sympathy drugs. That's how sick I was. And we got these drugs, and we got through his funeral, and he died without a will. And his sixth wife at the time, the business wasn't doing well. I wasn't able to run a business. I was more interested in partying and hanging out with this woman and all this kind of stuff. So we sold the business off for the assets. And it wasn't a lot of money. It was enough money to keep me in trouble for a while. And I was still with my wife and with this girl, and it was all of this, and we're using, and I'm using with one and going home and using with the other, and you know, and it was just a very bad situation. Well, what happened was, back where I used to get, and I know this is an AA meeting, but it's part of my story, so I hope it's not offensive to anybody, but what happened was, my dealer at the time used to smuggle cocaine in diesel fuel tanks. So the drugs that we were using smelled and had diesel in it. And so my ex-wife ended up having kidney disease because of it. And so she got really sick. And she couldn't have any babies. So throughout all of this sickness and all of this drama, we're seeing these fertility doctors and we're trying to have a kid, and she ends up having this kidney, so she had to have a kidney transplant. And so we're living in Hilton Head. I'd lost my house. No, I didn't lose it. I gave it away for the privilege to use drugs and alcohol. We were staying in an apartment in Hilton Head. My ex-wife is on dialysis. I had lost my business. I was floundering between jobs, working at the beach, flipping hamburgers, you know, whatever, making a little money here and there, spending it on drugs and alcohol. And my ex-wife, her parents came and got her. They lived in Philadelphia. And because I wasn't doing a good job taking care of her, and she needed help. And so they came and took her. They left me in that apartment with a leased vehicle that was behind in payments, and she left to go up there, and I met it, the love of my life. She liked to drink liquid codeine in the morning. I liked to drink Jack Daniels, and we were a match made in heaven, and real healthy relationship. You know, it was awesome, and I'm with this girl for about 3 months, and we're using, and she's using, and we're figuring out ways to get our drugs and alcohol and all this kind of stuff. And my ex-wife called me and told me she was pregnant. And I'm like, okay. And my brother, I was broke. I didn't have any money or anything. And my brother called me up, and he said, Dana, when Dad died, he had a lease vehicle, and when they turned it in, they were able to sell it, and there's $5,000 for you that I've been saving, and I didn't want you to waste it, but I want you to take this money and do something with yourself. So I called my ex-wife, and her parents gave us a house, and I left for Philadelphia. I left the love of my life in Hilton Head, and I left for Philadelphia with a gallon of wild turkey, an 8-ball of cocaine, a Ryder truck full of furniture, and a car and a tow dolly behind it in January, headed for Philadelphia. Perfect. So I get up to Philadelphia, and I started working in King of Prussia. I worked for a company like the company I used to own, And in Philadelphia, it's not like you can go to a Quick Trip or something and get a beer or something like that. You have to go to a package store and get a bottle or a case or something like that. And so what I would do is I would buy a case of beer and I would hide it in a snowbank. So I would have beer on the way to work and beer on the way home because they didn't want me drinking. They knew I was in this. So I stayed in Philadelphia for probably 3 months. And this is where it gets real. See, it's all fun and games and it's all this, that, and the other. But my wife was pregnant and I woke up in the middle of the night and I rolled over and I said, I gotta go. She said, what do you mean you gotta go? I said, I'm going back to Hilton Head. I wanted to get high and I couldn't do it anymore. And the selfish, sick, self-centered individual that I was left my pregnant wife on dialysis by herself in Philadelphia to go do what I wanted to do. Took the car, left her no car. And I went back to Hilton Head and I got in touch with this girl and I was got a job. They repossessed the car. I had a bike to go on. And I was working as a busboy in a restaurant. Showed up drunk. They fired me. And I was staying with one of the restaurant people's in his house. I was renting a room. And I was drinking all day long. And I was really, really sick from alcohol. And I was shaking and I was poisoning myself. I was dying. And I called my brother and he called 911 on me and they called an ambulance and they called me to the hospital where I had a blood alcohol of 5.4. And they put a catheter in me and they started to try to detox me and this, that, and the other. And I pulled the catheter out and almost bled to death. And I stayed in the hospital and some people came from AA and got me out of the hospital and told me they were going to take me to my first long-term treatment center. Well, before that, I'd went to Charleston to detox a couple times. I've been in jail, you know, all of that drama. And I went to a place called the Bridges of Hope in Argyle, Georgia. The Bridges of Hope is like tough love. You live out in a trailer with no electricity for the first 30 days. You slaughter your own food. You go out and you clean graveyard war museums. It was really, and I mean, here's this little preppy kid from Hilton Head who thought he was all that in a bag of chips, living in this trailer out in the middle of the woods with no running water and no electricity. And shave your head and all this nonsense. And I was like, this is crazy. But I was there and it's out in Argyle, Georgia. And I'm like, I got no way to go. And so, you know, you had to do your fifth step with this guy and he laid in a hospital bed and spit in a spittoon and told you how full of crap you were. And it was just, it was bad, y'all. And so, I'm out there. And they would put us in a van and they'd fill it full of sandwiches and snacks and we'd go and clean up these old Civil War graveyard museums to help pay our rent. And right next to an open grave, I had a seizure because they wouldn't give me any seizure medicine when I got to Bridges of Hope because I just came out of the hospital from that. And I had a seizure and I bit half my tongue off. And I fell next to an open grave and a guy put a shovel in my mouth and helped save me from dying. They put me in the hospital. And when I got out of the hospital, they said, well, you know what? We're not going to put you in these graveyards anymore. You're going to do housework around here. And we're going to, you know, you're going to iron and you're going to clean bathrooms and you're going to run this little store like they had in there. And in this store is where I discovered rubbing alcohol. And that was my first experience with rubbing alcohol. So I started drinking this rubbing alcohol, and I was in the middle of my fist step with this guy, and he's laying on this bed, and he told me I was full of crap. I told him to go pound sand. So I took my Louis Vuitton luggage, which was a black plastic trash bag full of everything I owned, and I hiked out of this place out there, and some people picked me up and dropped me off in this town, and they had some alcohol with them, and I called this girl from Hilton Head. She came to pick me up, and I went back to Hilton Head. Nobody wanted to see me anymore, and I from my business days, this guy put me up in a hotel, and I had a friend in Atlanta that said, you know, come to Atlanta and we'll just smoke pot, you know, and you can't drink, but you can stay with me and smoke pot. And I was like, okay, that's fine. So I came to Atlanta. I didn't have a car, I didn't have any money. And I got a job. I was staying over off Jimmy Carter Boulevard, and I got a job at a rental company like I used to own, cleaning equipment and delivering equipment. Nothing wrong with that, but that's where I was at. And so I'm working over there. I got a little piece of a car, and I'm drinking. Now I'm starting to drink again. And what I would do is I would paint a lot for this guy, paint a lot of his equipment. So, you know, if you're wearing a mask, good alcoholic, they can't smell the alcohol on you. So I was glad to paint. I'm like, sure, I'll paint. And so I would go out to Checkers at lunch and with $5. And $5 would buy the cheapest half pint of vodka and a Checkers burger. And I would drink the vodka, eat the burger, and drink, and then go to this guy's house and drink, and my boss at the time, I think he was one of us, he never said he was, but he took me to detox at Biscayne Room, and this was 1995. So back in Biscayne Room, back in 1995, they had a bedroom in the back. It had two twin beds in it. And there was a lady by the name of Margie that used to run, Maggie. And Maggie used to run it, and you would sit back in this bedroom, and they would feed you Gatorade and stuff like that, and you would just suffer, man. You were detoxing hard, man. I'm detoxing this room, and they'd parade me out there at the 5 o'clock meeting. Look, we got a wet one here, and I'd be like, I'm like fucking miserable. And so I detoxed at the Biscayne Room. I got out of there. I went to Carp on Candler Road. Didn't stay sober there. And then I told my brothers that I needed to go to Loradac, which is in Columbia, South Carolina. They sent me some money. I got a bus to Savannah, Georgia, where I had to stay with him before I go to Loradac. I convinced him to give me enough money to get drunk because I had to be drunk when I got there. I was in Augusta, got thrown off a Greyhound bus for drinking too much. Then this guy told me we could go buy some crack. I didn't even smoke crack, but it sounded like a good idea. And so we went out in the woods. He cracked me over my head, stole all my shoes and my watch. I called the cops, told them I'd been mugged, you know, and it's just getting this badness. So I went to Laredo. I went to Carp again for my second tour of duty and stayed sober for a few months. And then we went to Triangle Club for the 11:30 spirituality meeting, and this was back when Honey Beer came out. And we're on our way back from this meeting, so me and some of the guys, and we're like, well, you know, we've never tried Honey Beer. I think we'll go to the Braves game and try one Honey Beer. 12 hours later, I'm on Stewart Avenue with a prostitute smoking crack. I don't even smoke crack, right? So that allergy and that phenomenon of craving kicked in. And this is whole thing. So I end up going through all this, getting thrown out of Loradac and moved back in with my friend. And I got a job. I was back at a treatment center somewhere. Got a friend, got a job at this company called Abbey Rents down in the city. And I was delivering rental equipment, party equipment for them. And I was at this treatment center. And before that, I was at this treatment center. And one day I went and we took this truck to Canoe to go pick up this stuff after a wedding. And the people left half empty glasses all over the tables. So I went in the kitchen, told the chef that I was gonna pick this stuff up, and I stole a bottle of port wine, hid it under the motor compartment of the truck, and started drinking this alcohol, and I passed out in the truck. The owner of Canoe called the owner of Abbey Rent, said, "I think he's dead, come get him." They came, got me, and I left out of there, and I moved into my new residence, and that residence was under a bridge on Howell Mill Road. And I would panhandle for money, and I would steal alcohol, and drink what I could, and my friend let me back in his house, the one that said I could smoke pot, and I started drinking rubbing alcohol again, and I got really sick. In December of 1995, he came home to find me, and my tongue was swollen up like a hamburger, and literally looked just like a hamburger. And I was really sick, so they took me to the emergency room, and I was in a coma for 3 weeks. My family came in, read me my last rites, and they told me at best I'd be blind, you know, because of the poison that I put in me. So I stayed in a coma, and the whole time I'm in the coma, I think I'm Ray Finkel, the kicker for the Miami Dolphins. I don't know why I thought that, but that's all I remember. And when I came to, the doctor told me, he said, "Son, you can't drink anymore. I would suggest that you drink light beer or O'Doul's." So I'm smoking back then. So I'm in the wheelchair and I go down to smoke a cigarette outside, and the thought comes to me, you know, good old days is not that far from here. I'm at St. Joseph's Hospital. So I take the wheelchair and I wheel it up to good old days, start drinking, and get drunk, and they, some nice guy put the wheelchair in his car, took me back to St. Joseph's Hospital, and you know what the sad part it is? They let me out of St. Joseph's Hospital, almost dying. 3 weeks I was back in there again for doing the same damn thing. So I go back to live out under this bridge, and during this time my daughter was born. I hadn't seen her yet. I had pictures of her. And I'm living under this bridge, and you know, I'm drinking what I can, stealing what I can. I got my last check from Abbey Rents, and I went and stayed at Claremont Lodge for a week. And I had a $5 key deposit. And so I stayed in there. And now, take note, I'd been in the hospital twice, almost dead for drinking rubbing alcohol. And I'm detoxing in Claremont Lodge. I'm going to McDonald's, getting ketchup, getting mayonnaise, making soup, you know, trying to figure out a way to eat. I had no money. And this is how bad I was. One night, I was detoxing so bad, I called down to the front desk of Claremont Lodge, and I said, "Hey, I'm building an airplane model up here, and I've spilled some glue. Do you have any rubbing alcohol? Because I need to clean it up." I didn't have a model in that room. I was going to drink rubbing alcohol again after all that, because I needed it that bad. And so I got out of the, and when I was at Claremont Lodge, there was a bar next door called Dugan's, and and I would wait for people to leave the night, and I would take their alcohol that they would leave by the car and drink it. And after a week, I left Claremont Lodge, and I had $5 in my pocket. And I had been to jail for stealing mouthwash, drinking Listerine, this nonsense throughout this whole thing. And I decided I wanted to get help. And this was during the Olympics in 1996. And so back then, there was a place called Fulton County Drug and Alcohol Treatment Center on Boulevard. And I would walk the city, and I'd go to Fulton County Drug and Alcohol Treatment Center, and I'd try to get in, and they wouldn't have a bed for me, and I'd live outside, and I had one nice set of clothes in a backpack. And what I would do is I would go to like the Marriott Marquis or the Hyatt downtown, and I would steal the cigarettes out that people would leave them, and then I would go up in the elevators and I would eat the people's food that would left over from the room service, and I would steal the mouthwash off the maids' carts and drink it. And I'm trying to get in Fulton County Drug and Alcohol Treatment Center, and finally they said I could get in, but I needed to be drunk. I had $5 to my name. And I took that $5 and I went back to my old habit and I bought a burger, and the last drink I ever had was a pint of vodka right up there by Fulton County, and I got drunk. And they let me in there, and I stayed there for 30 days. And when I was in there, we were all in group, because it was funny, I don't come to Ridgeview very often, but I came in here and I saw the chairs in a circle, and it brought back a lot of memories, because that's when I was in treatment the way it was. You know, we all circled up, and anyway, I'm in the circle, and the cops come in and said, "Is Dana Rouillard here?" And I said, "That's me." And they served me my divorce papers. And by the grace of God, I didn't get up, because right outside of Fulton County Drug and Alcohol Treatment Center was a liquor store, and I could see it. And I figured I could sell some blood or something to get some money to go get some alcohol, but I stayed. And I got beat up when I was in there, and there was no fighting policy, but everybody rallied around me and said it wasn't his fault. They jumped him. So I stayed there, and then I got interviewed to go to a long-term treatment center down in the city right across from the Varsity, part of All Saints Episcopal Church, called Covenant Community. Okay? Covenant Community is about 14 beds. It's a lot like the extension. It's a life stabilization unit. And you get to go there for a year for free. And the first thing they did when I was there, they sent me over to DeKalb Addiction Clinic. And DeKalb Addiction Clinic was owned by the Woodruff, by the Coca-Cola family over off Briarcliff. So we would go there every day, and I got extensive treatment. So I went for 30 days to detox and treatment, and I went to Briarcliff for 5 months. And because I'd been to so many treatment centers, 7 long-term treatment centers, all of this nonsense, they didn't want to let me go. And I went there, and I learned how to get sober, and I learned how to meditate, and I learned spirituality, and I got a good firm foundation, and I got a sponsor, and I worked my steps, and I was probably about 6 months sober, and I went to work for a company that I used to do business with when I owned my business in Hilton Head, and they had a business in Atlanta. And I would clean their bathrooms when they were having meetings that I used to attend, and clean their warehouse. And I was making $8 an hour, and I was grateful to have it, because I could send my ex-wife $20 a week so she would have some money for my daughter. And I worked at this company, and they bought me a car. And the treatment center I was in there for 6 months, and they said, you either keep the car or you get out. And they said, you're never going to make it. And I remember picking up a glass of water, and I said, even if I take one sip like this, and I took a sip of the water, I said, I'm going to die. I'm not going to drink anymore. And they said, we hope not. And I took my car, and I went to go stay with a friend. And I still went to meetings, started going to a big book study, started, you know, still doing what I was doing, and I felt pretty solid. And my friend that said I could smoke pot with him, we were friends still, and we went to go play golf one night, one day. And we went to go play golf, and you know, I'd been in treatment for 6 or 8 months, and he's like, you know, let's go out and meet some women. And I'm like, sounds like a good idea. And he says, we're gonna go to this club I know called Johnny's Hideaway. And I'm like, okay. So I'd never been to Johnny's Hideaway. And as soon as I walked in Johnny's Hideaway, right, as soon as I walked in Johnny's Hideaway, it breeds of alcoholism. And so I got really nervous. You know, I remember I had about 7 months sober. And so my friend starts going to meet these women, and I'm just like, I can't be around this. We're gonna get out of here in a minute. So I started playing video poker. So this really good looking brunette comes up to me, and she says, what are you doing? Why are you putting money in that machine? And I said, well, I tell you what, if I win, I'm gonna buy you as much shrimp cocktail as you want. And she said, okay, and I won, and I bought her shrimp cocktail, and we got to be really good friends, and she's my wife today. And so we got married, and we met at Johnny's Hideaway of all places, right? And she hates it when I say that. She told me tonight, she's like, you want me to come with you tonight? And I'm like, no, I won't be able to talk about Johnny's Hideaway, and that rocks, man. So I, you know, and I've been sober since then, and so that's what it used to be like, what happened. And now let's talk a little bit about what it's like now, okay? So my life, okay? My life is about recovery. You know, John and they mentioned the big book study. I'm of the mindset that everybody in AA has a gift, whether it's sponsorship, book studies, prepping for a meeting, leading a meeting, whatever it is. My gift, God's gift to me, was I started going through the big book when I had about a year sober, and I fell in love with it. And I started teaching the big book. And I've been teaching the big book for 21 years. And I used to teach at a group over in Roswell, a bunch of guys, and we started a group with about 3 guys, and I taught over at that group for 17 years, and now there's 40 guys that go to that meeting every week. And I retired from that meeting 3 years ago because my vision for the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous is that I teach you the Big Book and you go and teach somebody else. And I had a blessing and an opportunity to teach at the men's extension, and I felt like that was where my talent would be, my experience, strength, and hope would be better used. So I started teaching at the men's extension about 8 or 9 years ago, and this is how God works, because it's God always works, you know that. God's always on the job. And you know, I was real comfortable. You know, alcoholics, they get comfortable in their environment. They don't like change, right? And I was going to this group in Roswell for 17 years, and when I left there, I was uncomfortable, you know? And 2 weeks after I left there, the women's extension called me and said, will you please come over here and take the big book study to the women's too? So now, every Wednesday night, I do the women from 6 to 7, and I do the men from 8 to 9. So I'm still in the big book, and I'm able to reach more people, and that group is still over there doing more, and people from that group are going out. So that's the big book. John talked about our home group and our retreat that we're part of, and you know, I stay active in that. I have a lot of absolutely wonderful brothers and sisters in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that I've gotten to know that want nothing for me except for me to stay sober, and all I want for them is to stay sober. And I have this friendship and these people in my life that are absolutely fantastic. You know, I talked about my daughter. My daughter's 24 years old now. Ever since she was 1 year old, I would go see her in Philadelphia and I would fly her back to Atlanta. We'd fly three flights, and you know, I was able to buy a home, and we made a room for her with a canopy bed and painted it pink and you know, and made her a home. You know, so when she came down, and she used to come down, her and my wife are great friends. My current wife, my ex-wife and I don't have anything in common with her. I don't dislike her. I don't like her. I just tolerate her, you know? And it's not, I don't have a resentment or anything. You know, it's just, we were young people and we've gone this way and we have this daughter together. And we both realized that we needed to be as amicable as to each other as possible to make my daughter as happy as possible. My daughter never sees us fight, never seen us fight. We don't fight, we do whatever. You know, we just put my daughter through college. She went to college at Bloomsburg University right outside of Philadelphia. And she got a degree in theater. She works for the University of Pennsylvania now in their admin office. And she does plays at night. She's a happy kid. She drinks like vodka cran. That's her thing. Like one. You know, she doesn't drink much and she's real responsible. And, you know, we have a great relationship. We talk. I mean, I've been a parent to her. I paid my child support. I did the things that I needed to do as a recovering alcoholic. Covenant Community, where I was in a treatment center at. One of the things from my background in special events and things like that, I started a Thanksgiving dinner for the homeless there 24 years ago. This would be my 24th year when I was in treatment. And every year at Covenant Community, all the guys from the community and the alumni, we get together and we shop and we cook and we feed 600 people for a homeless Thanksgiving dinner at All Saints Episcopal Church every year. And I'm on the board of directors for Covenant Community. And I was the one knocking on the door begging them to let me in 24 years ago. And so I'm part of Covenant Community. I do the book study. I got my men's group. I got my friends in recovery. My family, you know, my family trusts me. My family is part of my life. I've been on my current employment. I've been there 18 years. I'm second in command. That's not an ego thing, but my boss trusts me enough. And one of the cool things about it is he lets me hire the folks, and 20% of our workforce are people that are recovering alcoholics and addicts and the best dadgum workers we have, and we have a really good company and we work really hard. And what's really cool is you can come in my office anytime and you can close the door and we can talk about a recovery or a meeting, and it happens all the time in my office. That's what God put in front of me. I've been blessed. I still have a lot of work to do. You know, I still get in a lot of fear and worry, you know, things that I constantly need to work on. But I continue to work on myself. I consider this a journey. I don't consider it a destination. And I'm just on this journey. I'm on it with you all. And you know, like I said, I'm a planner, I'm an organizer. And I know God's here tonight, because how many times did you see me look at this book? Because all my notes of what I was going to talk about are in this book. Thank you. Have a blessed evening.